I don't want to repeat too much of what we did last time. So for anyone who's here who didn't hear last time, didn't hear the shiur of last week, it would be a good idea to listen to the recording to get that piece, because we're dividing up the study of the Megillah into three parts. The first part was the introduction to the different personalities in the Megillah, which is what we did last time. I would say that was essentially the backdrop to the story, getting to understand the personalities and the background story, or the motivations, or the character of the different personalities that we encounter in the Megillah. That was really the first part. The second part is going to be the plot of Haman and what Esther does to thwart the plot of Haman. And the third part, which will be next week, will be the celebration of Purim. And that actually, in a way, is going to take us all the way back to the beginning, because to really understand why Purim is celebrated the way that it is, you have to go all the way back to the beginning of the Megillah. But for now, we're really mainly in the third chapter, I would say, third and fourth chapter of the Megillah, which starts on page 1254. So just to very, very quickly recap, without going through all the important points, and again, really critical that if you're listening to this, you go back and hear the first part, because it will not be complete without that. But it would take up half the time to review it. Just to say the relevant bullet point highlights of last time. So we talked about the personalities of Ahasuerus, of Haman, and of Esther, respectively. And Ahasuerus being basically a self-indulgent, hedonistic, party animal type of guy. One type of bad person. A bad person who is indifferent to others because he's basically absorbed in his own pursuit of pleasure. That's Ahasuerus. He's not really wicked or evil or in a sinister way. He's evil because he is totally self-absorbed. And then you have Haman, who is more of a sinister character, meaning that he has an agenda. He desires power. He wants to dominate others. He wants honor. He wants respect. He's seeking, you know, he's a climber, a social climber, and so on. So he's really more of a calculated and sinister type of a villain, okay? And you can even see from the fact that he's not satisfied with all of the blessing that he has, all the material wealth that he's gained, because he's lacking the respect of Mordechai. It's like, it almost sounds absurd, but that's the way it is when you have when your goal is domination and you feel that your domination is incomete. So if it's not a total rise to power, so there's something lacking in the mind of Haman, whereas Ahasuerus probably wouldn't care about that as long as you continued to pass him the food and the wine that, you know, was his main interest. He doesn't really care about that kind of a measure of success, let's say, that Haman would be concerned with. In any case, so you have Ahasuerus, and Ahasuerus and Haman both have a quality that they share in common, which is they are both fragile personalities. They're both insecure personalities, and it's something that we saw last time. Ahasuerus is an insecure personality, and that manifests itself in the fact that he's always relying on other people to make decisions for him. He never comes up with his own solution to any problem. And he even feels a need to place a buffer between himself and the citizens, which is Haman. When he's almost assassinated, so all of a sudden he elevates Haman to a position of prominence so that there will be somebody else out front and he won't be the first address, let's say, to disgruntled people, won't target him. So he has a certain insecurity. And we also saw that he had the party 3 years into his reign, which suggests that it was somewhat unstable in the beginning. And it was only once it was stable that he had the party. And he had an enormous party to really impress upon people how great he was, how glorious he was, how wealthy he was, what a lifestyle of the rich and famous he was living, is so that he would create a certain aura around himself. But the ultimate goal of that aura in the mind of Ahasuerus is to enable him to continue with the party life, not for the kavod so much as for the benefit of living the so-called good life, as opposed to Haman, who's really seeking the honor and the glory. But again, is also an insecure personality, because a secure personality wouldn't be so deeply distressed by one person not bowing to them, you know, when they walk by, when he has everything, the person has everything, and they're so concerned with that, obviously is feeling insecure, has what they call an imposter, he has the imposter syndrome. They both do. Both Ahasuerus and Haman seem to be people who are insecure because they don't exactly, they feel like they have to justify the positions that they're in. And the rabbis give explanations for both of these. They say that Ahasuerus wasn't really royal in his blood, in his lineage. He was really, he married into the position of the of king, and that's why it took him a long time to prove himself. And Haman also has a backstory that he was a barber or whatever it is. You know, they have all these funny stories about Haman being kind of a blue-collar worker, let's say, we would say in today's language, who got into politics, and which, you know, happens occasionally, even in American politics, we see that, certainly in Israeli politics, people who come from sort of what we would call a blue-collar background end up getting into the world of politics and sometimes attaining a pretty high position, and that's what happened to Haman, but you're always looking over your shoulder and feeling a little bit like, how did I get here, and, you know, how did I make it, and so having to justify it, having to prove it, feeling very, very insecure if somebody challenges you or if somebody calls into question your your position. So this is Haman and Ahasuerus. And then we talked about Esther, and this is where we're really going to focus this time, because we have to understand what Esther did and why it was successful. And so Esther, we saw the quality of Esther that we noticed was that Esther is a very astute student of human nature. She is not governed by her emotions like the other two characters that we were introduced to, Haman and Ahasuerus, who are really at the mercy of their emotions all the time and are dealing with all these feelings of insecurity and all of these desires that they have and fears and anxieties. She's not that kind of a person. She's actually always observing others and responding accordingly, which is really the way of a wise person. So in the situation of choosing how she's going to have her date with the king, instead of choosing her dream date and coming up with a fantasy date to have with the king, she consults with the advisor of the king to get an insight into what Ahasuerus would perceive as the ideal date. And she hides her identity. Now, somebody pointed out on one of my chats after I distributed this shiur of last time that it actually says that Mordechai told her to do that, but still, it's the same point. Mordechai and Esther are a team. Esther's idea in hiding her identity, what I had suggested last time, is there are a lot of different explanations why and a lot of different reasons people give, and people are often perplexed by this point of why exactly did she hide her identity? I mean, what was the goal in hiding her identity? Did she know that it was going to become relevant at some point in time? I don't think that that's the point. I think that the emphasis is that she wanted to give as little as possible, reveal as little as possible about herself, because the less you reveal about yourself, the more potential influence you hold.
Well, the more reasons why, like one of the things that she wanted to know when it says Ahasuerus took Baikach Betulot Shenit.
Right. He's trying to pressure her.
Trying to pressure her to find.
That's what the Chazal said. Yeah.
Isn't that the reason why, like, by not saying, it actually worked to her benefit?
Right. Well, in general, what you find about Esther is that she keeps, unlike today, where people feel like I need to lay everything out. I need to go on social media and just expose everything about my life and my personality and every detail of who I am and just like make it public. Unlike that, she's exactly the opposite. She's a good poker player. She keeps her hand very close. She doesn't show too much of who she is. Just the minimum. Even when it came to the encounter with Ahasuerus, what will he like? I'm not going to say what I would like. What would he like? And the same thing goes with the identity, as I mentioned in the last week. That once you reveal your identity, you automatically are going to be loved by certain people and either suspected by or disliked by other people based on that identity alone. Like once you say, I am Jewish, okay, let's just say in this case, that would be it. So immediately people who are Jewish are going to feel an affinity for you. They're going to feel a connection to you. They're going to identify with you. And the people who are not are going to feel kind of excluded. A person, like I had given an example, who has kind of like olive complexion, you know? So some people will say they're Jewish. Some people say they're Israeli. No, they're Latina. No, they're Italian. No, they could be Persian. They could be all kinds of different backgrounds, North African. They could be any kind of a background. And everyone is going to project onto that person, that celebrity, whatever they want to believe about that celebrity. But as soon as he or she comes out and says, I am this, so all of a sudden they're going to start to form an opinion. Oh, I don't like that guy. Oh, that's not what I thought. So that mystique, what I call it is she keeps a mystique about herself as a strategic For strategic reasons, not because she knows specifically that there's going to be, obviously, the events of Purim, she doesn't know, but that having a mystique around her gives her a certain type of a power. It increases her popularity. Like even the Chachamim say, the rabbis say in the Gemara, that everybody claimed her as one of their own. Every nation thought, oh, she's one of us. Oh, she's from Media. She's from Persia. She's from here. She's from there. Because everybody wanted to claim this new queen as their own, and she kept it secret. Right. They weren't Jewish. Whatever she did, right. It's a matter of identification. And you see that today in many fields, but especially any kind of a public role that a person has. If they play up their ethnic or religious identity too much, they're always going to risk alienating certain groups. They might draw certain groups closer, but they can also alienate certain groups, no matter what that identity is. You know? Yeah.
Do you think that this style of not showing not wearing your religion on your shirt or whatever it is, on your head. This is like a very Middle Eastern, Middle Eastern Jews in general. We practice our religion was the way anyone all over the Gulf, anywhere. They never told anybody that they were Jewish. Even my late grandfather, my father-in-law was in Iran, said we never spoke about who we are. If somebody asked or whatever, they knew. But other than that, you live your life as a Jew, how you act with your mitzvot, but they never.
Well, it's the opposite of today. Today, everyone has to broadcast every single detail about who they are and what they are and what they like and all that to the world. It wasn't like that in those days. I agree that it's probably somewhat cultural, but I think also in this case, especially you're being thrust into, I just try to imagine, just imagine yourself being thrust into a position, a public position, a political position, and revealing your identity is basically saying, I am with certain people. I remember when Joe Lieberman was like running to be vice president, there was a lot of concern. Oh, Jewish people might have said like, oh, it's pretty cool that a Jew, a religious observant Jew is running for such a high office. But on the other hand, everyone who's not a religious Jew is saying, I don't know about this. Even if they liked his politics or whatever, they start to be concerned. I remember when I was working as a school psychologist in my internship when I was, many, many years ago, I worked in a public school. And, we had a mentor who would go over our sessions or whatever we did, and talk with us. And in one case, like one of the kids or one of the mothers, like asked me, are you Jewish? Okay. And I said, yes, I think I said that I was because she asked me and I didn't think I should not tell the truth. But I asked my mentor, and the mentor basically said that you should say to the person, oh, do I need to be Jewish in order to understand what you're going to tell me? Right? Even though the mentor was also Jewish. Meaning, like, the point was, don't make it an issue, because the minute you say, yes, I am this or I am that, I could say I'm Jewish, and then the student who isn't Jewish is going to feel like, oh, there's a disconnect now between me and this person because Jewish. So, like, there's a strategy in downplaying the uniqueness of your identity when you're in a position of somewhat a leadership position of that sort. So in any case, but I want to just get back into the story again. So now that we understand that Esther is a person who is always thinking about what the other people are thinking, she's not allowing her own fantasies, dreams, aspirations, agenda to motivate her. So that's a really key element to the story that's exactly the opposite of Achashverosh and Haman. Because Haman manipulates Achashverosh, and Achashverosh just wants other people to make decisions for him so he can continue partying. He couldn't really care less. So when they make the decree, so we saw that Haman's whole approach to things, which we saw both Mimuchan in the beginning of the Megillah as well as Haman, is to take his personal vendetta against Mordechai and to make it into some kind of a noble cause. The reason why I want to persecute the Jews is not because Mordechai offended me personally, but because Jews are bad for the kingdom. Right, because people who don't follow the rules of the kingdom don't belong here. They're undermining, they're tearing apart the fabric of our nation. Nothing to do with my personal issue with Mordechai. Of course not. I'm not that petty. How petty do you think I am? No, it's a matter of principle. That's what Haman says to Achashverosh, and Achashverosh doesn't even bat an eye. He doesn't care. That's why Achashverosh is a different kind of a wicked person than Haman. Haman is literally willing to murder, to to commit a genocide, literally willing to do that because of his own personal vendetta that he elevated to the level of some kind of a noble cause for the sake of Persia, for the sake of the empire. Okay? But Achashverosh is willing to go along with it, but for a different reason. Not because he's the kind of person who would initiate that, but because he's the kind of person who doesn't care. He's the kind of person who says, well, if it means if I can give you the money to do that and we can go back to drinking, then it sounds like a good idea. That's what it says. As soon as they passed this decree, they sat down and they had a drink and they didn't care. Right. So for him, he doesn't even ask, who are the people? What is the story? What did they do exactly? What are the things that they're not following in the king's rules? You know, all the things that Haman said. He doesn't ask any questions. And even when Haman offers to pay for it, which sounds like, look, I'm taking one for the team. I'm such a good servant. I'm willing to pay for it. Ahasuerus says, no problem. I'll pay for it. Let's just go back to drinking. Who cares? You know, that's a different kind of a wicked person, a wicked person who just doesn't care. Okay, now, we come to the story of Esther and how Esther resolves the crisis. So we know the conversation between Haman and Achashverosh. And so in Perek Dalet, in the fourth chapter, 1255 at the bottom, Mordechai discovers what's going on, and he's tearing his garments, and he's crying, and the people are, and he stops coming into the king's, you know, because he was actually part of the king's cabinet, or one of the officers of the king. He doesn't come in anymore because he's wearing mourning clothes, and you're not allowed to wear clothing of that is for mourning, not mourning the time of day, mourning of, you know, avelut. I don't know how to say another word for it in English, but you don't, for Shiva or whatever they would do for sad times, you don't wear that kind of clothing in the king's palace. You know, you're not allowed to, so therefore he stayed outside, and Esther hears about it, and she tries to send him clothes to change, because she thinks maybe, I don't know, maybe he had a problem with laundry. I don't know why she did that, but she doesn't know why he's not coming in, and why he's wearing these clothing. And he eventually informs her of the situation. Now remember, nobody knows that there's a relationship between Mordechai and Esther all this time, because that would have given away Esther's identity, which is why they're always speaking through messengers. And they're speaking indirectly, and only at the end of the story does Esther tell Achashverosh who Mordechai is to her all this time. Okay, so it never has become clear up to this point. Everyone knows that she knows him and he knows her, but they don't know why exactly they know each other. In any case, he tells her, "You'd better do something." And this is what happens on 1256. It says that everybody knows. So when he tells her, you need to go talk to the king and intervene to stop the genocide of Haman. Everybody knows that you can't go into the king's inner chamber without being summoned, and you could be killed unless he lifts his scepter towards you and shows that he favors you. And I haven't been summoned to the king for 30 days. Right? Now remember, what we did last time was we looked at the timeline of the story, and we realized one of the things that I was pointing out last time that many people don't realize is how long of a timeline the story of the Megillah happens over a decade. It starts in the third year of the king's reign and it ends in the 12th year. So all of this, Esther became the queen in the 7th year of the king's reign, and this is happening in the 12th year. Okay, so she's already been in the position for 5 years. Okay, and there's, I guess, you know, like with every relationship, there are ups and downs, and they haven't been talking, and things have not been like they once were, so she hasn't heard from him, and she feels a little bit nervous approaching him. Okay? But in the end, Mordechai basically makes her, says to her, look, you can't imagine that you're going to be saved and all the Jews are going to perish. If you don't do something, salvation will come from another source, but you will be the one who disappears. So you better do something. In other words, we know that the Jewish people will be saved. Notice, he doesn't mention God. He doesn't mention religion directly. Anywhere in the Megillah, he doesn't mention. Right? You have a choice. You can either be an instrument of this salvation, or you can just be a footnote in history and this will be over. Like, this is your opportunity to do something. And she says, okay, everybody fast for 3 days, and then I'm going to come in, and if I'm lost, I'm lost. Meaning I'm going to take a risk, and I'm going to go in to speak with the king. Now, for 3 days, she's fasting and praying, and her attendants are fasting and praying, and the Jewish people are fasting and praying for 3 days, and she finally goes in. But during those 3 days, what we discover, what unfolds in front of us in the course of the story, is that she clearly has developed a very, very sharp strategy. Now, in any strategy, we're always limited by circumstance, right? The best laid plans, doesn't matter if circumstances contradict them, undermine them, conflict with them, they won't work out the way that we had imagined and envisioned. In this case, the circumstantial conditions end up favoring her plan, but she doesn't go in without a plan. We're going to see that she has a plan. What does she do when she comes to see the king? And I think that in here, you really have to take a look at the language of the Megillah to get a sense for the way that she presents her plan and what she's doing. She comes in, and of course, the real moment of truth is that she doesn't know whether the king is going to kill her or not, okay? She passes test number one. For whatever reason, he decides not to kill her. We don't really exactly know why. Just happened that way. And then in verse number three, in chapter five, it says, the king said to her, "What malach ester malka? What do you have? Meaning, what's the issue? Uma bakashatech ad chatzia malchut v'inaten lach. I'll give you up to half the kingdom, whatever you want. Say it and I'll give it." So he's in a good mood. Maybe he's very excited. She wanted to see him. She risked her life to see me. Wow, I feel, I don't know. Who knows? Whatever it was. But she says to him, "Vatomer ester, im al ha-melech tov, if it is good in the eyes of the king, yavoa melech ve'aman ayom el ha-mishteh asher asiti lo." Now there's a lot to unpack in this sentence, but first of all, she says, if it is good in your eyes, I want you and Haman to come to the party asher asiti lo. Now in Hebrew, right, and it's very vague because when you speak to a king, you also speak in the third person. So to say, come to the party that I made for him, could mean that I made for him, meaning you, but you're not allowed to speak directly to the king, so you speak in the third person, and you say that the king should come to the party I made for him. That's how you would say. Or the king and Haman should come to the party that I made for him, which sounds like it means Haman. Okay, there's ambiguity in what she say.
Well, we know he was jealous.
Oh, right. So, but we don't know that. We don't see the full fruition of it yet, right? So she says this statement: "Come to the party I made for him. The king and Haman should come to the party I made for him." Which him? We don't know. We don't know. Actually, we never find out. Actually, right? So the king is not the only one perplexed by it. No, nobody knows what she actually meant, and that was perhaps on purpose, right? Now they come to the party, and there's one thing that the king knows about this party. Do you know what the king knows about this party 100%?
It's
going to
be a party.
It's going to be a party. Well, that's all you have to say to him to get him to show up. But it's even more than that. He knows one thing. This cannot be the reason that Esther risked her life to come into my chamber to invite me to a party. That's not the reason why somebody risks their life. There's no way. There's got to be something she wants. Right? If you invite somebody to a meeting, you say, "I'd like to meet with you. I'd like to meet you and have dinner with you in some fancy place." You know that they want to meet with you for something. They're going to discuss some business. There's got to be a reason, right? So at the party, he asks her, "Vayomer ha-melech l'ester b'mishteh ha-yayin, ma she'elatech v'inaten lach u'ma bakashatech ad chatzi ha-malchut v'te'as." Now, he says the same thing. What do you want? Up to half the kingdom I will give you. Now, there also could be here a little bit of a, competitive feeling. Because, Haman is there, and the king is like, remember who actually can do for you. It's me, the king. What can I do for you? Now, what does she do? This pasuk is one of my favorite psukim in the Megillah, because you feel in this pasuk what she is doing to the mind of the king. Listen to this king. Listen to this pasuk. Vatan Esther vatomar. Esther answered and said, "She'elati u'bakashati, my request and my petition. Im matzati chen b'nei ha-melech, if I have found favor in the eyes of the king, v'im al ha-melech tov, and if it's good for the king, latet et she'elati, to grant my request, v'lasot et bakashati, and to do my petition." Say it already! How many phrases do you need to get to the bottom line? What is it already, right? You're waiting for her to spit out what is the request. How many times do you have to repeat that there's a request and there's a petition? So a person listening to this is like sitting on the edge of their seat. It's like when they're announcing the winner of some raffle, some contest, and they're talking so slowly, building up. And you're like, okay, get to it already. What is it? She says, Yavo HaMelech VeHaman, El HaMishteh Asher Aseh Lehem, U'machar Aseh Kedvar HaMelech, please let the king and Haman come to a party tomorrow. That's what, I have to wait another day. After all that build up, I thought you were at least going to say something.
Well, apparently there's something that she's telling you, Kedvar HaMelech, Right, maybe.
I mean, the Midrash tries to suggest that, but I'm just taking according to the Pshat. Right? According to the Pshat, he knows that there's something that she wants. That's why she called this meeting, okay, this party. She is building up, like she's about to announce the winner of whatever it is.
Days of a meal, and then the second that she asked at the meal, she already brought it to another meal.
Right, yeah. That's the thing. So, like, that's the whole point. He's on the edge of his seat. She's building up in her whole speech that, oh, if I found favor and if it's good and if you to do my petition and to, what is the request? Please come tomorrow and I'll tell you. It's like the worst possible thing. It's like when somebody sends you a message, can we please talk tomorrow? I'd like to have a talk. And you're like, oh my God, what is it? What could it be? What do they want to tell me? And the whole time you're going to start stressing out now because they said they want to talk to you tomorrow. Right? So she did that same thing. Okay? She did it, well, the first time was this, at least the same day. He thinks he's going to find out. Okay, I'm going to be wondering for a few hours, like, what's going on? Now I have to go the same next day. Now, think about, that's Achashverosh. So what's Achashverosh thinking right now? Something is going on. I don't know what it is. It sounds like something I should be worried about. What does it have to do with Haman? Why is Haman being invited? Okay. What is it that's concerning the queen that's such a big deal that she risked her life to come in and request a meeting with me and then doesn't even tell me what it is and asks me to come the next day? She's thinking a million things in his mind that I don't know. Obviously, I don't know what's going on right under my nose in my own palace because there must be something here that I'm not aware of. And he's freaking out and he's stressing out. How is Haman feeling right now? He's feeling the best of his life. Right? Not only am I the only person invited to this, I'm the third wheel in the in this relationship between Esther and the king. Like, I'm getting invited to their private dinner, not once, but twice. I'm invited again tomorrow. Wow, I am seriously, you know, I've really made it. I'm like basically as close to being the king as I could be. Even the queen invites me. Together with the king, that won't invite the king for a dinner party without me. Look at, I've really made it. And what does he do? He goes home. Now it happens to be that on his way home, he sees Mordechai. And Mordechai doesn't budge, doesn't recognize him, doesn't acknowledge him, nothing. And that makes him very angry. But he comes home and Haman doesn't have any compunction about gathering people together in order to brag. Which is, you know, something in our culture would be unusual. Right, but he brings all of his friends together and his wife, and he starts telling them about how great he is. This is in verse 11. Haman tells them about his great honor and wealth and all of his children and how he's been elevated. And Haman said, "Af lo evia Esther amalkai mamelech el amishter she'asata kimoti." Even the queen Esther invited nobody to the party except for me, and I'm invited again tomorrow. But there's only one thing: it's all worthless whenever I see Mordechai sitting there, not acknowledging my greatness.
So his hate was more...
His insecurity, yeah. He's so deeply insecure, right? He has very fragile manhood, we would say. Fragile masculinity, I don't know. So he he cannot tolerate the one person not honoring him, even with everything else that he has. But the point is that think about... Now, Esther couldn't have predicted that piece of the puzzle, right? That piece of the puzzle... She couldn't have known because she's not going to know that he's going to see Mordechai at that moment and all that. But what she does know, I would suggest, is that she has basically, with one action, created two totally opposite emotional reactions in two people. Right? Because in Achashverosh, she has created anxiety. She has created insecurity. She has created fear. She's created worry. She's created suspicion and jealousy and all bad stuff. And in Haman, she has pumped up his ego probably as far as it possibly could be inflated by making him feel that he's on top of the world and pretty invincible. To the point that the one thing he wasn't willing to do before, which is just say, let's kill Mordechai, now all of a sudden he's willing to do it. Because Zeresh says, well, if you've reached such a high level, right, why now is he willing to kill Mordechai and he wasn't before? He had to make an excuse. No, let's kill all the Jews. He was too embarrassed to just want to kill Mordechai alone. Now he's willing to do it. He's like, look at how high I am. I'm invincible now. I'm untouchable now. So Zeresh is like, okay, you're untouchable. So why don't you just go and tell the king in the morning to kill Mordechai and be done with it. Okay? So he's feeling, think about the difference between the mental state right now of the king and the mental state of Haman. And then look at that. I'm going to listen 1 second. And then Haman, then look at the first verse of chapter 6 and see why it makes sense. Okay? What happened that night? The king can't sleep. It's not just because he had coffee too late. He had chai, too late. Right? He can't sleep because he's worried. He doesn't know what's going on. And he's stressing out. And he asks to bring, what does he want to read? He doesn't ask to bring, he doesn't watch one of those Turkish movies in Farsi in the cable, okay? Because they didn't have that back then. What does he do? He says, I want to read Sefer Zichronot Divrei Yamim. I want to read the annals of the Persian, meaning whatever's been going on in the kingdom. Because he's trying to figure out, I wasn't paying attention until now. Now I'm paying attention. Did I miss any signs here? You know? Right? It puts the whole story into a different... Once you see that detail of why does he look and try to investigate, what am I missing? It's because he realizes there's something he's missing. So he starts thinking... It's like when you start to suspect somebody of doing something, then you don't understand why they're acting in a suspicious way or a way that's raising your... You know, making you concerned or making you jealous or whatever. You start thinking about everything that you've seen and observed. Hey, I noticed that they were doing this and I noticed they were doing that, and why did I miss that red flag and I missed this? So he's all of a sudden going over everything to see what he might have missed. I'm sorry, I kept you waiting for a long time, and I hope you remember what you wanted to say. Yeah. Okay. 100% plan.
Twice.
Oh, yeah. 100%. She's trying to create it for a reason, because if you look at the personalities of Ahasuerus and Haman, so Ahasuerus, they have a codependency, we might call it, and you know that there is Ahasuerus is very, very dependent on Haman, and he's the person who gives Ahasuerus his feeling of stability and safety and security, and you're not going to be able to put sunlight between Ahasuerus and Haman normally. And if in the first meeting, Esther had just come straight out and said to Ahasuerus, you know, actually, this guy Haman, he's actually a jerk and he's a bad guy and he wants to hurt my family. Haman would be like, oh, she doesn't, what does she understand? She doesn't really know anything. She's just a woman anyway, and she's in the palace all the time. She doesn't understand the politics and she doesn't understand the issues and what, you know, how, so that's, and Ahasuerus would be like, oh, okay, yeah, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Everything will be fine. Right? She's playing them like a fiddle, is what we would say. Okay? So she needs to create tension between them so that Ahasuerus can even entertain the possibility that Haman is actually a bad guy. Because if she had just revealed the truth in the first meeting, just like if there's somebody that you love and you're very connected to them and you have a very positive view of them and you're very close with them and you rely on them and you've been trusting them for years. He's been in that position for years. And that person, all of a sudden someone comes and says, you know, actually that person's not trustworthy and they're really bad and they're doing something terrible. You're going to be like, you don't understand. You probably had a misunderstanding or he probably said something you didn't like, or he offended you somehow, or he slighted you, or however it is, you're being hysterical. Whatever he would say to dismiss or downplay it, right? So that's why she has to first create a situation psychologically where Ahasuerus can even hear this possibility.
So you said that Haman was very insecure?
Yes.
But
Ahasuerus
was also insecure.
In different ways,
yeah. So they fed each other security?
Basically.
Ahasuerus would not be able to kill Haman in the first night.
Yeah, he wouldn't be able to even think of the idea that Haman was bad. He does, because he makes him feel safe and everything is stable. I have everything under control, which is exactly what Ahasuerus would want to hear. Meaning if Esther came in and said, you know, Haman is planning this terrible thing, Haman would say, no, she doesn't understand. This is a very important political issue. Don't, you know, she's just a woman. Whatever they would say back in those days, you know. I'm not saying that that's a valid statement, but that's what he would say, something like that. And, you know, what she does, she's not involved in political matters, and she's not... You know, she's not privy to all the information that I've access to. Whatever he would say, and Ahasuerus would, of course, immediately take that as a good explanation and say, okay.
Sorry, how is she creating that tension by saying, come to mom?
Well, yeah.
I get that she's creating that sense of anxiety in him and that sense of blindness, but how is that getting between them?
Well, it's going to get exacerbated in a second, but just at this moment, Ahasuerus is already now concerned and worried that things are going on that he doesn't understand, including why is Haman involved? Is there something going on between Haman and Esther? Is there something, you know, what is the role? Why is Haman involved here? Is Haman being set equal to me in some way? And that's why he's invited every time that my own wife has to invite him. Is Haman somehow involved in this? Is there some kind of a, is there something going on swirling around me that I'm not paying attention to and I've been missing? So, right, she's planting the idea in his mind. I don't know if you ever saw the play, if you ever read Othello by Shakespeare, but, you know, just putting the thoughts in the mind of the king is enough that he's doing all the work that needs to be done psychologically, which is what we do. You put one little hint and we'll do the work. You don't have to do anything more. If you overplay it and overstate it, actually, you blunt the effect. You know, we're much better at creating that in our own mind. And that's what he's doing. All night long, he can't sleep. Meanwhile, Haman is going to have his defenses down. Because Haman feels like, I'm at the top of my game right now. He doesn't realize that Esther invited him as part of a ploy. He might think that Ahasuerus was in it too. Right? He knows that the party was done by Esther, but maybe he thinks she said, oh, do you think we should invite Haman and the king was part? He doesn't know. Right? So as far as he's concerned, he is the top VIP, the most coveted position in the world. And so he's not thinking he's about to get blindsided by Esther, that's for sure. Okay, now the situation gets exacerbated because now, and this is part of the where you see circumstances play a role that Esther didn't have a direct, have a direct influence over. That Haman is now coming in the morning to tell Ahasuerus, and this is in the beginning, in the middle of chapter 6, that he wants to kill Mordechai. And Ahasuerus has just come across in reading the records of his kingdom that Mordechai is entitled to a big reward. So when Haman comes in, and now you can understand even better the background of or the causative factors here. Haman comes in and Ahasuerus asks him, what should I do for somebody that I really want to honor? It's not just by chance that Haman thinks it's him. It's because of what just happened that Haman thinks it's him. In other words, he just was invited as a VIP, the only VIP guest to a dinner with the king and the queen. And now the king is saying, if there's somebody I really want to honor, what should I do for them? Of course he's going to think it's him. Right? So Esther indirectly, you know, facilitated that happening by pumping up the... He never got to ask him, right? He had come to do that, and then the king is like, who's in the courtyard? Oh, it's Haman. Oh, tell him to come in here. So he thinks he's coming in because he wants to give him a big surprise. He's actually just wanted to ask him, what should I do for Mordechai, right? He doesn't know, but we operate with schemas, right? We always have sort of like a framework that we're seeing the situation through. Right? Yeah, we're processing it through a certain framework. His framework is, right now, I am the center of everyone's attention and I'm on top of the world. So if the king is inviting me in and asking me this, of course, it's about me. So what does he do? He describes his own personal wish fantasy. Yet another example of somebody describing their own fantasy. And what does he do? He says, oh, yaviu levush malchut, bring the kingly robes and the sus, asher chavalav ha-melech, Vasher nitan keter malchut b'rosho, and put the crown on his head. Okay? So basically he's saying, let the guy be king for a day. And then go and parade him through the streets and say, go tell everyone this is what we do for a person that the king really loves. Okay? So what is Haman thinking? Oh, obviously this is for me, right? So he's describing his own wish to be king for a day. What is Achashverosh? And Achashverosh, by the way, understands exactly why Haman described what he did. Okay? Achashverosh is no fool. We know. Right. So that's what the Midrash says. The Midrash, the Chachamim say, it's brought in Masechet Megillah, all the good Midrashim about the Megillah are mainly in there. It says that when he said the Keter Malchut, that the king gave him like the evil eye, so to speak, when he heard him say, you should put the crown on the person's head, the king gave him a look like, you don't put the crown ever on somebody's head besides the king. Okay? What are you even thinking? And that's why when it describes what was actually done for Mordechai, it doesn't mention the crown. Right? He didn't actually do that. But Achashverosh, if there was any signal, further reinforcement of the idea that I should be suspicious of Haman right now, because there's something going on that I don't see, that's another piece of evidence. In other words, when you're operating, when you see somebody that you, in a positive light, you take all the evidence that supports the positive view, and anything that sort of makes you question, you push it aside. Once you start constructing the opposite, and you have suspicions, and you have fears, and you have jealousies, and this, you take every negative piece of evidence, and you stack that up. It's like when you, if you have a certain political allegiance or affiliation, anybody from the other party, you'll only see everything that they do. It's only for money, and it's obviously only for this agenda, and it's obviously only for power, and they're only bad. If they do something good, it's for a bad reason, and if they do something bad, it's also for a bad reason, right? That's how people are with politics. So that's exactly how we are with humans, right? If you've decided a person is bad, then whatever evidence supports that narrative that they're bad, you're going to accept it at face value. And whatever might seem like they're good, you're going to discount it. And now that's what Achashverosh is changing his view of Haman. So he's already started to get jealous and suspicious. What is going on? Why is he involved? And so on. And now he hears him describe a desire to be king for a day. And he starts to think, you know, maybe this guy is getting a little bit too, you know, his head's getting a little bit too big. So when they come to the party, now Haman now, and this again is not something really that Esther could have directly anticipated, Haman went on a roller coaster. He was brought yesterday to the top of the top of feeling that I am the most amazing person ever. And then he was humiliated because he had to parade his own enemy through the street saying, this is a guy that the king loves. And he was totally, you know, pushed down and made to feel miserable, and he comes home totally distraught, totally, you know, out of sorts. And at the very moment he gets home, he tells his wife what happened, and his wife's like, oh, and the Chachamim say to him, oh, if Mordechai is a Jew, this means you are destined to be destroyed. Your downfall is coming. That's it. It's all over. What happened? Just yesterday you told me I was going to kill Mordechai and everything is amazing. Now you're telling me this? Right, but they believed in reading signs and fatalistic beliefs and superstitious beliefs. So it's just like, that's the whole reason why he decided to base killing the Jews off of a lottery. If he had just killed them that day, he would have been done. Instead, he said, "No, I need a lucky time, so I'm going to make a lottery and choose a day a year from now." That was his own, you know, his own stupidity saved us, right? That he did that. So now he hears from his wife, "Oh, you are doomed. If you messed with a Jew and things started coming undone, you're finished." So now he has in his mind, I'm finished. So he's really all rattled. You have to think of Haman. Esther would have had him just have his guard down. But now it's gone even further than that. He's been like totally unsettled.
Is that from everything.
The timing of everything. That's what's called Purim, the chance events. They all fall into place. But obviously Esther manipulates it too. Right, I would say Esther's plan could have worked without this piece, but this piece definitely helps. Meaning, if he had come feeling, I have nothing to worry about and I'm so great, and Achashverosh was already suspecting him, that might have been enough, you know, Dayenu. You know, but the fact that he also has this additional encounter where Achashverosh sees confirmation of the idea that this guy is really very ambitious and this guy really has designs on me possibly wanting to take my kingdom, and that Haman got humiliated and also like psychologically demoralized by his own wife in the aftermath of it, So that has put him on this sort of roller coaster that he's not in a good place, let's just say emotionally. He's not in a good place, right? Yeah, now it's chachamav, right? Right, they don't love him anymore. Well, that's why I always said there's one of the jokes about the Megillah is how do you know that Haman's wife didn't love him? Because it says that he sent for the people who loved him and his wife. and then how do you know that she wasn't smart? Because it says he spoke to his wife and the wise people. So it's just anyway, but the he is rushed. It says Vayavhilu Lavi et Haman. Like in the midst of all of this, he's trying to process that I just went from being on top of the world to being totally humiliated, and my wife just told me I'm doomed. I don't know what I'm. You know, his head right now is mivulbal. We say it's totally confused. He's totally out of sorts, and in that mental condition, he's rushed to the party. So he's in normal circumstances, possibly under normal circumstances, Haman would have been able to smooth things over. He would have been able to, he would have had his wits about him. He would have been able to respond to what Esther said. He would have been able to diffuse the tension or something. But he wasn't in the right mental state. So at the party, when Achashverosh again asks, what is the story? What are we doing here? She says, and this is on page 1258, and it's verse 2 and 3. The king says to Esther, same thing, I'll give you half the kingdom. Same thing she said before. If I found favor with you, and it's good, what I want is my life. And my people is what I'm asking for. Because we've been sold to be destroyed. And if it was only to be slaves, I wouldn't say anything. But this doesn't give any benefit to the king. This is just to destroy. No benefit whatsoever to the king. No concern for the welfare of the king. Because this person is somebody who doesn't care about the damage that's going to be caused to the king. He doesn't care. Okay? So, of course, the king says, Vayomer HaMelech HaChashverosh. Now, one of the tricks in reading Tanakh is if it says the word Vayomer, and he said twice, Vayomer HaMelech HaChashverosh, Vayomer L'Esther Malka, and the king HaChashverosh said, and he said to Esther, it gives you a sense of somebody who's panicking. Right, right. With the language. Mi hu zeh ve'ezehu. Who is it and who is it? He says it in two different ways. It's giving you the idea of he's panicking. He's getting emotional. Right? Who would want to do this? It's a very bad person, Haman. Okay? So she built up to the point of allowing Achashverosh to become panicked and jealous and suspicious and hearing all of this and realizing in that moment that he didn't fully vet whatever the plan was that Haman had, and now that he doesn't necessarily assume that all of Haman's intentions are glatt kosher anymore. So when she said, this guy doesn't care about the harm that's going to be caused to the king. It's not worth it to him. It doesn't matter to him. So all of a sudden, he is willing to see Haman in a different light, and she builds up, Ish tzar voyev, a very bad person, Haman. So, you know, and now the king becomes enraged, and he runs out of the room, very angry, and Haman starts begging for his life, because again, Haman isn't in his usual form. He's not in his usual masterful, political, smooth form. So he falls on begging onto Esther, and he falls on top of Esther, which of course wasn't his intention to do that. But now that the king has decided that Haman is a bad guy, what is he going to interpret that as? Hagam lichbosh et hamalkah imi babayit. You're now trying to jump on the queen with me in the house?
She said he's bad.
Right, he said he's bad. But the point is that now that the king has that new changed view of Haman, when he walks in and sees that he fell, instead of saying, oh, he probably tripped, you know, or on top of her, he assumes that he's trying to assault her right in front of him. Okay? Which, again, lichbosh et hamalkah, to conquer the queen. In other words, that's something that a king who conquers another king takes the wives. That's what they used to do. So Avshalom did to David. Right? So like, that's something that they would do to show that something lions do even. Right? When the new lion comes and he kills. He kills the predecessor. Right, they take the females. So that's the idea is lichbosh. He wants to conquer. You're trying to become the king. You want to take over. This is the ultimate sign that you want to take over. You want to take my kingdom. And of course, he already had all the jealousy thoughts about the fact that Esther was inviting him already in there, even though it doesn't even have to make sense at this point. But he has every suspicious feeling towards Haman. He's willing to see, to reevaluate all the assumptions he made about Haman, about his intentions being pure, about his purpose in wanting to eliminate that nation that he never named, being for some noble cause. All of that thing now falls by the wayside when you realize that really he's a devious guy who's trying to take my kingdom. He wanted my crown and he wanted my queen.
Okay. That he was he was an impulsive person.
He was always, right?
So
he always.
Let me build on his impulse. He'll make a decision.
Exactly. He makes in the moment impulsive decisions under the influence of whoever's manipulating him, right? So when he was at the original party in the beginning, Memuchan gave him advice. He went with it right away. His servant said, let's do a beauty contest. He goes with it right away. And Haman says, let's do a genocidal plan. No, sure. Anything that he hears, He's willing to go with it. He makes decisions on the spot impulsively without really thinking them through. And then what does Charvona say? Charvona says, by the way, Haman wanted to kill Mordechai. He put a gallows, 50 Amotai gallows at his house in order to kill Mordechai, who spoke good about the king, who helped the king. Oh, so all along he was trying to kill the people who were my actual allies and friends. The person who saved me from the last assassination plot, which was to get rid of to take my power. He was trying to get rid of people like that.
Right?
Who? No, it says that he was actually a bad guy too. It's funny. The Chazal don't like Charvona. They just say that he saw in the moment the tide was turning and he's like, you know what? When you see the tide is turning, you take the other side and you pile on, right? So he decided to take the other side and pile on. But basically, he saw to it that this was going to end very quickly because he said to him, just to show you proof of how bad Haman is, it's not just Esther's family and people that he wanted to kill. He wanted to take the person who would have told you about whatever plots he had against you, of course, now that you're suspecting that he wanted to do that. Right? Who was the person who informed you last time somebody wanted to take over, wanted to rebel against you, wanted to assassinate you, wanted to seize your power? Mordechai was the one. Haman wanted to kill him. That is a proof that he wanted to eliminate everybody who was actually your ally in order to usurp your power. Now, that wasn't really true, but it didn't matter because the stage was set now for Achashverosh to unleash his wrath on Haman. And this, the reason why it's such an amazing story is because obviously it went beyond in many ways. The circumstances went beyond Esther's plan. Esther's plan seems to have been to create some kind of a friction between Haman and Achashverosh, to create jealousy and suspicion in Achashverosh, to create invincibility feelings in Haman so he wouldn't be prepared for what was about to hit him. Okay, and then in the intervening events with the story with Mordechai being paraded on the horse and the exchange between, right, it became exacerbated because now Achashverosh saw Haman and even already started seeing Haman in a negative light. And Haman was even more emotionally debilitated on his side from parading Mordechai around, you know. And then Charvona adds to it by pointing out that connection between Haman and Mordechai. Now Haman wanted to kill Mordechai specifically, even though Mordechai was an ally of the king. So those elements Esther didn't have control over, but she orchestrated, meaning without her orchestration of, her creation of the conditions for this to happen, it wouldn't have exploded the way that it did. It just happened to be that the additional conditions that were, that came along and circumstances, sort of chance circumstances that fed into it, paved the way for a very speedy resolution to the problem, even speedier than she might have been able to anticipate. But we see from this how much she understood the psychological makeup of Achashverosh and the psychological makeup of Haman, and how she understood what would be necessary to disconnect, to unplug Achashverosh from Haman, so to speak, so that he could see Haman in a different light, see him in a negative light, even entertain the possibility that he could be a bad guy, and how to make that, how to close that deal in as quick and dramatic a way possible before Haman saw what was coming, before Haman saw what was about to hit him. Because if he was prepared, if he knew that he was about to walk into something like that, he would have come up with some kind of an answer and some kind of explanation, some kind of excuse. But he wasn't prepared, so he wasn't able to defend himself. And in fact, in his emotional response to the whole situation, he falls on top of Esther and makes it even worse for himself. But, yeah.
I mean, now what you're, I don't know why, it's just like a Simon Nafal, like all of a sudden I realized what you just said about Chavona, because we say at the end of Racha, but Gam Chavona.
Zachor Letov.
But now I understand what he did. That's the straw that broke the camel's back. That at that moment he said that. So that's when he said, "Hang him on."
Right, hang him on. Tilu olav, two words.
That's why we say that. But I didn't know that the Chazal.
They say he wasn't really a good guy, but you know he did a good thing because he sealed the fate of Haman in the quickest way possible. Otherwise, maybe Haman would have said, "Okay, can I have a trial? Can I?" I don't know what it would have done. You know, he would have wanted to get a lawyer. He would have wanted to go have due process. Who knows? This way it was quickly done. It allowed that. It could be that it would have thwarted his plan already, but Charvona enabled the situation to be resolved more quickly. Yes?
I'm just looking back at the part where
he's
saying he dressed Mordechai, and it doesn't say that he put the crown.
Yeah. Right, he didn't.
He didn't
give permission. That's why I think that's why the Chazal are inferring from that. In other words, they're saying that from the fact that Haman suggested to put the crown, but then in the end that wasn't done, that shows you that like that was stepping over a line. Like you don't do that.
And he started getting
but you can imagine that Achashverosh would perceive even to entertain that possible request means that you're thinking about that as a possibility, right? Right, exactly.
Why does that not occur to him?
Because he still hasn't. She created enough ambiguity that he could even think that it was Haman. Until that point, he never would have even believed it. Right? At that point, he already started to turn again to see Haman with a more suspicious eye.
Nothing to do with her.
Right, nothing to do with. Right, because of the seeds that she planted in his head. Right? So now she has to build up this idea that there is a person who has designs against you and he actually is wrecking your kingdom and he actually doesn't care. And he's a bad person who wants to harm me and really wants to harm the kingdom.
Not knowing
who it's going to be. And he's like, okay, who is it? Tell me who it is. It's Haman. I knew that guy was no good. He's saying that this person doesn't really care about the king's benefit. This person really only cares about himself. That's what he's saying. So now he can believe that because he sees that, oh, Haman is not what I thought. And then when Charvona says, not only does he not care about the welfare of the king, not only does he have ambitions that possibly, you know, undermine the king's position, he actually took a person who saved the king's life from the last group of people or two people who wanted to kill him and usurp his power and wanted to kill that guy. Obviously, you know, that suggests that he wants to do things without it coming to the knowledge of the king because Mordechai would be the person who would normally reveal it. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That it's a lesson for a woman. Yeah, it's a lesson. I mean, part of the story is contrasting the attitude of, and I'm going to get more into this next week, so I don't want to talk about it too much, but contrasting the attitude of the Jewish characters, which is that situations are what you make of them. Meaning, we're never a victim of a circumstance. We say we have to strategize and plan and be as proactive as possible, and we don't say, "Oh, we're doomed," or "Oh, we're just blessed now, and we're just gonna coast," or "We're doomed, and we shouldn't do anything." We always seek to employ some kind of a strategy as best as possible, meaning to the extent of our sphere of influence, whatever that might be. And if there are things that are outside of our control, there are things that are outside of our control, like there were in the case of Esther, but she still strategized up to the point that she could, and she didn't just say it's in the hands of fate and there's nothing that we can do about it. Whereas whereas you see that that Haman, from beginning to end, he puts everything in the hands of fate. He wants to make a lottery to decide when to kill the Jews, and then he wants to, and then when he hears that he's doomed because he hears, oh, my fortune is really great, so I should go try to kill Mordechai. But then he hears that his fortune is doomed. And in every case, he feels that fate is what is determining the next step, and not his own choices or the intelligence of his choices. I mean, the most obvious one is the lottery in the beginning, because the fact is that it gave time for them to reverse the decree, as opposed to somebody who wanted to get something done quickly, that they would act like immediately. They wouldn't say, let me do a lottery and decide when is a lucky time to do it. You know?
I have a question. It's a little bit past, maybe beyond the scope of the idea of the characters, but where did Haman's sons play into this? Why were they?
Well, it seems like they were also cut from the same cloth as Haman. I mean, it's the idea is that everyone who was killed, you see throughout the entire Megillah, the people that they killed were all the Mivakshei Ra'atam. Whoever wanted to kill them, those are the people that they killed. So it wasn't like, so obviously they would have been of a like mind. It's interesting that it never mentions the women, meaning it doesn't say that Zeresh was killed or anything like that, even though you would think she would be a bad person too. It doesn't actually say that. It only says that the sons, who I guess were in cahoots with Haman, would be, were killed. But that's what I would assume, and that's why they also hung them up. They must have been important, like a family. It was like a mafia family. It was like, you know, the sons were going to take over afterwards. They were all hung together to say that the end of, you know, that the regime of Haman is over.
I feel like I've heard this somewhere, but I'm not sure. Wasn't part of Esther's strategy a little bit of flirtation with Haman at the party? So he kind of, like, he fell for her, and then that kind of played into... Kind of him,
it could be. I mean, I wouldn't discount it. I mean, I think just the very fact that she invited him, and he saw that the invitation came from her, maybe he felt like, you know, felt there might be something there. Could be. Definitely in Achashverosh's mind, the Midrashim say that he was a little bit jealous. Like, he saw that she had some kind of an interest in Haman. He didn't know what that interest was. It was the opposite of maybe what he had suspected. But yeah, I'm sure that there was an element of that too, that she wanted to do anything possible to kind of put him in a mental spot that he wouldn't be prepared for what was about to hit him.
The second time, yeah, when she were at the meal, when they were first time at the meal, that's when she invited Haman, it was through Ahasuerus. Haman didn't hear it.
Right, the second time he saw that it came straight from her. Right, so he probably was very flattered. Yeah, I would assume so. You know, so... Who knows what he was thinking? Who knows? All right. So Bezrat Hashem, next time. Go ahead.
Is there do we see any response from Esther when she walks in to Ahasuerus's court and he doesn't kill her? Does she have any surprise? Is she surprised at that?
Well, she definitely didn't know what was going to happen. So she prepared herself as best as possible and prayed for the best. But it doesn't say that she showed any specific reaction, just that she knew that she was taking a risk when she walked in. And that was how he knew that there must be some bigger issue here than you just want to have dinner, because that wouldn't be a reason to place your life at risk.
One other thing I just realized, maybe perhaps also when she said to fast for 3 days and not eat, not drink, when you're coming in front of someone, you're pale, you're this, so he already saw...
She was distressed. Could be. It could be. That's a good point. It could be.
There's something. She doesn't look the same person that I met, or whatever it is. Something's off.
Something. That's a good point. It very well could be. I had mentioned in last class that there is one movie that was made of the. It's real. Yeah, it's really, really excellent. It really brings the story to life. Yeah, it's a very powerful movie. Right, it's a real rendition of the movie that sticks very much to the text of the Megillah and everything. And it's. I'll try to get the link, and I'll give it, send it around for everyone. It was free on YouTube. Yeah, I sent it around. We watched it last year in my own family. Watched it on Tanit Esther last year, and it really affected our Purim. Like my kids and my wife, we really felt like the story was so much more real to us when we read it in the Megillah after watching the movie, because it really brought it to life. The Haman was perfect. Even the Achashverosh was really well played. Yeah. It's called Esther, but it's, I think, right?
Yeah.
But it's like it's part of a series of like movies on biblical books, some of which are pretty terrible, a couple of which are really good. The Jeremiah one, Yirmiyahu, is really, really good. It's perfect for Tisha B'Av watching, and the Esther one is really true to the text. I'll try to send around the link so everyone can see.
Not Charlton Heston.
No, it's really true to the text.